duties for the Division for Service and Mission in America of the American Lutheran Church. I work with congregations that are undergoing change because of change in their communities, whether that change be economic, age, ethnic, lifestyle, whatever. And I work with them trying to talk about options for their future and responding to the limits placed upon them to find creative ways for new ministry. The whole subject of creativity has fascinated me, and that's why I chose the title Chaos, Creativity, and Love. Some elements that I'm trying to put together in my understanding of the creative process. And it, I think my first interest in this really was deepened and sparked by the accident experience that we went through 9 years ago, because suddenly, as a result of that, a lot of things that I'd wanted to do in my life happened. I'd always written, you know, plays when I was a little kid. I used to organize the neighborhood kids, and I had a wealth of brothers and sisters. There were 8 children in our family, so, and I was the oldest girl, so I used to organize them into plays, and I'd say, now you say this and you say that, and I remember my mother shouting out the window, will you please stop saying you say this and you say that? But I was always directing neighborhood plays. Then the usual poetry writing in my teens, and then playwriting later on, and then film writing, and always drawing. But I'd always thought it would be neat to write a book. But I never could think of anything to write about. So when the accident happened, sitting in the waiting room that first week outside of ICU, I just thought, you know, we're going to write a book about this. And it's going to be called, What Do I Have to Do? Break My Neck? To learn some of the things we were learning then. And all of a sudden, I had this heightened awareness of what was happening. And I'm not usually terribly observant. I couldn't tell, you know, if somebody said, what did Mary look like? I couldn't tell them after I'd met her whether she wore glasses, what kind of clothes she was wearing. I go into people's homes, and even though I've been there a number of times, I couldn't tell you what color carpeting they have. But at that time, I experienced this heightened consciousness of where I was. And I remember the colors on the little rectangles on the wall that had people's names on them who had contributed to funds to keep that hospital, South Coast Hospital in South Laguna, going. And I remembered the sounds of feet coming in, down the corridor. I could recall, and I can now, the smells in that hospital. And all those things, I had heightened consciousness. And so we did. Since that time, 9 years ago, we have written together 4 books, and I've written 2 books alone in 9 years. And as I was working then with people who had gone through crises and wrote this book, The Critical Moment, that we talked about the other night, one of the things I observed in their experience was also this sudden burst of creativity. People who had gone through crises would suddenly start writing poetry, or they would start journals and write beautiful. They would send me copies of pages from their journals, just exquisite writing. Or they'd start painting pictures or doing sculpture and writing music. One woman got a gift of song, and she has a little hymn book she's published, or a song book, I shouldn't call it hymn book, that she wrote during a period of great stress when a good friend of hers was dying of cancer. And these songs would just seem to come to her. And then after the friend died, she couldn't write the songs anymore. So I wondered about all of this business of creativity and whether or not crisis is necessary. But I thought it can't be, because otherwise people could never express their talents unless they had these critical moments. But one thing I did come, a conclusion that I did come to, is that chaos of some kind is necessary in the creative process. And up on a friend's wall, I saw this quotation from Nietzsche, Chaos Trusted becomes a dancing star. And then I saw another one of my favorite artists is Corita Kent, the former nun, whose display of artworks became a traveling art show. Do you remember in the late 60s? Especially for the 450th anniversary of the Reformation, the Lutheran Brotherhood Insurance Company funded a traveling display of her artworks. There were serigraphs and silkscreen prints, a beautiful display, and she's one of my favorite artists. And she paraphrased this and said, "You must carry a chaos within you to give birth to a dancing star." And I like that. So I've tried to, you know, put together in my mind what it is about chaos that gives birth to creative activity. And I found a good ground for that in Genesis chapter 1, where it says, you know, in the second verse, "And the earth was without form and void, and the Spirit of God brooded upon the face of the waters." And then in the next verse, "And God said, let there be light." And I think that that's kind of a very good illustration of the whole creative process. There must be a time when there's formlessness and voidness in order for us to give birth to some creative product. And I use that term carefully because I don't think we can really talk about creativity without some product as a result of the process. I think if we say he or she is a creative person, but that person never produces anything, how do we know that that person is creative? Creation implies a product as a result of chaos. So then I thought, how can we help people become creative persons to realize their creative potential? Because I think most of us have creative potential. So some of the things that have occurred to me are that we don't encourage chaos in persons. What we try to do is bring order very soon into the lives of children. And I want you to think now, I'm not going to ask you to do it. I could if you have a piece of paper, go ahead and do it. I want you to make three lines on a piece of paper, and then we'll talk about it. Make three lines.
Horizontal or vertical?
Make three lines on the paper. Okay. All right, how many of you made three lines like this? Okay. Now, you see, I didn't tell you to make them horizontal or straight or vertical. And but because from early childhood, when we were told by our teachers, draw three lines, that was what was expected of us. Now, you could have drawn three lines that look like this. And that would be three lines. But we're early conditioned to have order. And perhaps all of humankind is bent to create order out of a universe that, what's the second law of thermodynamics? Entropy is the tendency in all of nature to death and decay. And I thought when we lived in North Dakota in Grand Forks, and I used to do quite a bit of traveling then, speaking and going to meetings and stuff. And I used to fly out of the Grand Forks International Airport. And I used to love to look down at the terrain. How many of you have flown over that part of the country? And you know how beautifully quilted the landscape is, and the rectangles and the squares and the mile square roads that transect the landscape. But then the Red River of the North comes along, and it just disregards all those boundaries. And it goes cavorting and dancing across the landscape, and just chaotically. And I thought how we're always trying to box things in. And that's what we do very early with children. And we help them solve their problems very quickly. We show them easy ways to do things. And we discourage creativity. I brought this cartoon with me. And I like the New Yorker cartoons. I'll leave it up here if any of you want to look at it. It's one of my favorites. Here is an assembly line. And there's five workers. I can't tell whether they're women or men. But anyway, they are working along. It looks like women. They have long hair. And here they're all going tippy, tippy, tap, tap. They're knocking on shoes. Tippy, tippy, tap, tap. Tippy, tippy, tap, tap. Tap, tap, tippy, tippy. Tippy, tippy, tap, tap. Down in the second line, the two sitting next to this nonconformist are holding their hammers up and looking over there with frowns on their face. And down here, they've all stopped working except the nonconformist, and she's still going tap, tap, tippy, tippy. But they're all staring at her, you know. So down here, tippy, tippy, tap, tap, tippy, tippy, tap, tap, tippy, tippy, tap, tap, tippy, tippy, tap, tap, tippy, tippy, tap, tap. She's gotten the message. You got to do it the way everybody else does it. So now, I'm convinced that God encourages diversity and uniqueness and nonconformity, but that we rebel against it. And I think it's part of the nature of humankind to rebel against diversity. That's what I find when I work with congregations and changing communities, is we want to reach out to our kind of people. God has created people of all colors and all races and all languages. And we say everybody's got to talk the same, everybody's got to look the same, and everybody's got to sing the same hymns. You know, regardless whether their background is Germanic or Scandinavian, they may be Hispanic, Black, Asian, but in our place, they all got to be like our kind of people, and everybody's got to conform. And so in Bosque County, Texas, where Erling and I were married in Cranfield's Gap, Texas, you know, that in Bosque County, a predominantly Norwegian county, the story was told that all Blacks had to be out of the county by sundown, except one Black man. And you know why he could stay? He spoke Norwegian. So, you know, he became our kind of folks. But we resist diversity as being peculiar and somehow or other bad. Now I'm going to ask you to engage in a little fantasy, which some of you may have engaged in before. It's from John Stevens' book, Awareness. And I'm going to ask you just to close your eyes and get in a relaxed position. And relax by taking a couple of deep breaths. Get your body totally at ease so that it's not in the way of your imagination. And when you feel your body is free, then I want you to imagine yourself as a rose bush. I want you to feel the roots pushing down into the soil. I want you to feel the soil. Is it sandy? Is it black, rich? Is it dry? Is it moist? Is it hard-packed like clay? Is it loose? Push down in that soil. And as you push down into it, then you feel a stalk rising up out of the rose bush, pushing up out of the ground into the atmosphere. You sense the air around you. What do you feel? Is it sunny, warm? Is it raining? Do you feel cold? Where are you located? Is it in a familiar spot? Beside rushing waters? A still lake? In a meadow? In a cultivated garden? You push up a little further. The branches come out. And now you feel leaves budding, bursting, opening. Look at those leaves. Are they soft, fuzzy, gray-green? Are they dark green with hard edges, shiny, brittle? You push out a little further and you sense the roses beginning to form and bud, and now they slowly unfold. And you look at their color, smell their odor. What color are the roses on your rose bush? Are they yellow, red, white, peach? How many are there? Are they large and full, small, delicate? You feel yourself a rose bush. And now very gently you open your eyes and you leave the rose bush. You're back here in this room. I wonder if anybody would care to describe your rose bush for us. What kinds of roses? What was it like? Anybody?
I had, as I went down into the earth, I ran into a couple of rocks.
Okay. All right.
It's cold and windy up there.
Okay.
I had small red buds only, which seemed to me another life, another beginning. It was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mine was soft, moist, in my garden, pink roses.
In your own garden, pink roses. All right.
There's one roadside and a kind of rambling road and climbing up a side of a wire going up to a telephone pole. It's interesting to move from one stalk, and you reminded us that we were a rose bush. I went to stalk, and I went back and tried another root.
Okay. Anybody else?
I was in my own backyard.
Okay.
By myself, with bushes about 30 or 40 feet away.
Okay.
Right in the middle of the backyard.
When you said a stalk was coming up, it wasn't the rose bush. I was already there, and it was another plant, and I was just enjoying the plant.
Okay.
That's strange.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fascinating that I gave you all the same instructions. You heard my voice droning on, and you all had the same instructions. But I would wager that if we had time to go around the room, we would find no two experiences similar. Because out of your own unique background, who you are, you produce something that's uniquely yours. So I think, you know, God, who made all the fingerprints in the world different, and that boggles my mind. I really don't believe it. I think they're just, you know, trying to sell us a bill of goods when they say everybody's fingerprints in the world are different. What, 4 billion people? Almost 5 billion coming up? And we all have different fingerprints? How in the world can there be that many combinations? I don't believe it. You know. And they tell us that all the snowflakes are different. I don't believe that either. How can all the snowflakes be different? And that glacier up there that may have started, I don't know when it did, maybe before Christ was born. And all the snowflakes that fell to produce that glacier and the great, what's the name of it, Mendenhall Glacier up in Alaska, largest in the world. Every snowflake different? So diversity must be God's idea. God has created all of us different. I've spoken all over the country to thousands of people. I've never met any that look alike. And yet all we have is two eyes, a nose, a mouth, two ears, you know, all the same parts. But how can there be that many combinations? So obviously, you know, our passion for putting things in order and making them conform seems to me to stifle that Spirit of God, which is bubbling up in everyone to give expression to the gifts God has given us. But that is just the beginning of the whole thing. What's actually the nature of creativity? Suppose we did somehow or other set people free. How does creativity occur? I think it's, I brought some books with. This is in the library. I have it at home. I love it. Courage to Create by Rollo May. This I found new. I didn't have this one, Creativity, in the library. This one I bought in the bookstore because I wanted it for a long time. It's in the library also, however. Conceptual Blockbusting. I love it. It's very good. And in the critical moment, I deal some with chaos and creativity and some of the factors that make chaos the matrix for creativity. But there must always, in the creative process, be an encounter of some kind. An encounter with an object, like a tree, a flower, a person, and you become engaged with that object or with an occurrence, the happening when Erling broke his neck, where you struggle to find meaning. You become engaged with that object or with that occurrence, with that happening, in some profound way, so that the artist who sees a flower, you know, we could just pass that flower and say, oh, another flower. And one artist can look at that and see the water lily and struggle to find the essence of meaning in that water lily and paint something that people look at forever in museums. Because they're looking for the form, the essence of it. And you see the progress that is made in some artists, if you've looked at their exhibits, Picasso especially, who lived a long lifetime and started out drawing the usual nature things and then began to see forms. And finally, you come to the point where you just see the geometrical forms in a tree, the tree that's shaped like a circle or the tree that's shaped like a triangle, the trees out here, the pine trees that maybe look like spears standing up, and maybe instead of a forest of pine trees, it would become spears. To look at surfboards on the beach is fascinating to me because they take their surfboards when they're through surfing and stand them up in the beach. It looks like a forest of surfboards there on the beach. But to encounter something and become engaged with it, to take time enough to engage yourself in the encounter is very, very important. So it takes people who have maybe heightened powers of observation, who are willing to observe in new ways. And for instance, when Dr. Bowman was here teaching, he sat here, you know, and he kind of hunched over, and I sat there for several of his lectures, and pretty soon I just became so enthralled with Bowman as a rabbi that I brought a sketch pad with and some pastels, and so one day I just sketched him, his profile, and his nose is even more crooked and bigger than mine, and he has these glasses on and he has his beard. And so I drew a picture of him as a rabbi with a little skull cap on his head, because it seemed to me that the essence of Walt Bowman was a teacher, and a rabbi is a teacher. So I had to draw him as a rabbi, and I gave it to him when he left with a little note. But it's our need to give expression to a form that we see in an object or a person or an incident with which we become engaged. Marilyn Knutson has had a lot to do with Montessori teaching. And we've been walking at 6:30 in the morning for an hour. We talk about Maria Montessori. And Montessori, the basis of her whole teaching technique is that you provide children with all kinds of materials. You know, blocks of wood and whatever. You just provide them with these materials and you let them become engaged with the materials. And out of that engagement, they become intensely occupied. And one of the rules that Montessori lays down for this whole teaching thing is you never disturb the child at work. Never. You never interrupt the child to say, what are you making? You never even interrupt him to pat him on the head and say, you're doing a good job. You let the child engage intently with the objects in the room. And you set limits. All right. In Nietzsche's book, The Birth of Tragedy, he talks about Dionysian and Apollonian elements in creativity. That somehow or other, the creative person has to combine Dionysian elements, which are passion and vitality. You know, Dionysus, the goddess of Dionysian festivals were wine and and being,
body appetites.
But passion and vitality have to be combined with what he called Apollonian or the Apollos, the god of the sun, the orderly movements of the sun from sunrise to sunset, day after day after day, with order and form. And that produces kind of an ecstasy. And if you watch children in a school, very, very young children who are working at a task, we call it play, but for them it's work, there's almost an ecstatic quality about it as they engage with materials and produce a block structure or something out of clay. I used to teach art for 12 years. I directed day nurseries, and I was the art teacher. And to watch a child engage with the materials, there in front was the easel with a blank sheet of white paper. And the child had to engage with a brush and with paints. To watch the child pick up a brush, decide on a color, and put the brush on the paper and make the first creative movement of a line. That line is the child's product. And to watch the child is just a fascinating process. I used to love it. And all children, some studies have been made of millions of children's drawings all over the world. Now, children in every culture seem to start using drawing materials in the same way. Give a child, very young, and their scribbles all take the same form. It's just interesting to see that and to see how they branch out. But in every culture, children will start by making some kind of a circle. And if you watch a very young child, let them scribble. Don't ask them what it's supposed to be, but let them scribble, because scribbles are the first beginnings of creativity. Or a line will come. And often the second line will cross the first line. And perhaps the most primitive art form of all is, does anybody know? What do we call this? How many have seen your own children produce those kinds of forms? Mandala. You know, the very, very primitive art form. But as soon as we start imposing on children our ideas of what's good art, they lose that. But it's important for them to start with their own expression. All right, then passion and vitality. You engage with the materials or the incident or the person. And then you bring form and order. But not too soon. You have to trust the period of chaos. And that's where I think we often stifle creativity. We must trust chaos. I had a young woman call me about a year ago. Yes, it was a year ago. And she was writing a dissertation for a PhD in education. And she called from Thousand Oaks, where they were living now. Her husband at this time is the director for camping ministries for Southern California. And she was just desperate. The tension was in her voice. And she said, "Marge, I'm desperate. I've got a deadline of 2 weeks to get in an outline for my dissertation." And she said, I thought I knew exactly what I wanted to write. I had it all in my mind. Everything was in order. And when I sat down to write, it all left me. Totally. She said, I'm desperate. I don't know where to begin. I don't know how to put it together. And I was able to tell her, you know, trust the process, that this period of chaos is extremely important. The thing to do now is to leave it and go do something else and wait. Because with chaos, there's an incubation period. And I know some of you have experienced that. You must trust that. Chaos trusted becomes a dancing star. So I could say, trust the process. This is a very important part. You will come out of it with something better. Because somehow or other, your unconscious part of your mind is struggling to produce a gestalt. And a gestalt is a wholeness. And something's missing in what you had originally, or your mind wouldn't be struggling so hard to create chaos, so you don't produce an unfinished picture. Because our being struggles to produce wholes. And so she did. She let it go, and she went for a visit to some friends for a week. And while she was there, the whole thing came. And she got her PhD this spring. But, and as she said, it's better than anything I thought of before. Because she let it go. We were talking this morning, and Erling happened to mention while we were talking to Jane Reiki, something that Rollo May experienced, and I guess you had forgotten Rollo May had that experience. But Rollo May was talking about a hypothesis he had that about anxiety, and he was working with unwed young mothers, and his hypothesis was that. I had a good sound hypothesis on anxiety, approved by my professors and approved by me, that the predisposition toward anxiety in individuals would be proportionate to the degree to which they had been rejected by their mothers. But now he discovered in working with these young unwed mothers, who certainly ought to have a lot of anxiety, that he wanted to show that their original source of their anxiety was their own maternal rejection. He discovered that half the young women fitted his hypothesis beautifully, but the other half did not fit it at all. The latter group included young women from Harlem and the Lower East Side who had been radically rejected by their mothers. And he couldn't figure it out. Why was it? Here was this radical rejection, and they had no anxiety. They said, well, we can't worry about it, you know. We're just going to wait and see and all that. And he was trying to figure it out, and he couldn't. He struggled with it. Finally, late one day, he put aside his books and papers in the little office I use in that shelter house for unwed mothers. I walked down the street toward the subway. I was tired. I tried to put the whole troublesome business out of my mind. About 50 feet away from the entrance to the 8th Street station, it suddenly struck me, quote, out of the blue, end of quote, as the not unfitting expression goes, that these young women who didn't fit my hypothesis were all from the lower proletarian class. And as quickly as that idea struck me, other ideas poured out. I think I had not taken another step on the sidewalk when a whole new hypothesis broke loose in my mind, I realized my entire theory would have to be changed. I saw at that instant that it is not rejection by the mother that is the original trauma, which is the source of anxiety. It is rather rejection that is lied about. Now you see, the middle class young women had been rejected by their mothers, but the mothers had pretended out of their own guilt that they still loved them and they were as precious to them as ever. And it was the fact that they lied that produced extreme anxiety because they didn't know where they stood. The girls who had been kicked out of the house soon found friends on the street and their own peers, and they coped with it. But how can you cope with a situation that you're not even sure of? So it was rejection. But that breakthrough came at a moment when he had laid aside everything. And there, the reason chaos has to be trusted is because there's part of us that isn't under conscious control and doesn't have a guard up all the time that's working to produce this wholeness of ideas. Sometimes that'll happen to me when I'm speaking, and I have to do a lot of speaking in my job and spontaneous speaking and a lot of preaching. And it's sometimes in the process of speaking that I understand what I'm doing. You know, that it all comes to me, that this is what needs to happen in this congregation. But I have to trust that. Now, it took me a long time to trust that. And Erling still kind of, it bugs him that I will go to preach at a church and all I know is the text, but I don't really know how it's going to come out. I've studied it, I've prepared, but I say, I don't really know what I'm going to say. And it's often just at the moment, or even while I'm talking, and I will know it. I will know that this is it. Now, what does that say about the creative process? The creative process must have limits imposed. And those limits must be set, or they must happen. Now, I think what happens in that creative process with chaos is chaos and crisis push us up against the limits of our existence so that we begin to deal again with all of those essential questions of life. You see, the person in crisis is on the edge of unknown territory. The world has become a psychodrama played on a stage where some of the characters have disappeared or changed roles or rewritten the script. The lines are all wrong after years of saying them the same way in the same role. You have to create a new part for yourself, rewrite the lines to fit a new plot, work out new stage business to keep your hands and body moving as you get into your new role. Crisis forces an encounter with life's basic realities. Against our will, crisis engages us in hand-to-hand combat with our own mortality. And the greatest limit of all placed on any one of us is death. And until we come up against our own death, you know, we are limited in our creativity. Because death is the great deadline. Death is the great deadline. After that's deadline. See, you can't do anything after you're dead. And that's what pushes us, so that often people come more creative in their old age. And they find that creativity is one of the features of ability, one of the abilities that does not lessen with age. Roland Bainton in his 80s is still writing and teaching. Einstein became more productive as he grew older. Memory might fail. You can't remember, you know, what you did 2 minutes ago or what somebody said to you a minute ago. But creativity, because you're coming closer to the deadline. So it's important to set deadlines for yourself. If you're going to write a book, tell yourself what the deadline is. Even if you can't get a publisher to publish it, say, I am going to write the book by October 31st. And you will do it. Parkinson's Law said, you know, you'll fill in the allotted time with activity. And if you only have half an hour, you'll get as much done as if you had 3 hours. So if you set a deadline on council meetings in church and say we're going to be through by 9:30, you will be through. Council meetings that last till 12:30 in the morning are ridiculous. You can get as much done. So set deadlines. There must be limits. Children have to have limits. A playpen, a room, a yard that's fenced in. Because the limits push the child's imagination to say, how can I extend the limits? How can I get over the obstacles? Children must have limits. Limits are set by playmates, by parents, by teachers. Not order and not conformity, but limits that push a child to problem solving. Necessity, we say, is the mother of invention. And that's exactly it. Something has limited something we want to do, and we will create something to push those limits. Aaron?
I recall in junior high school an attempt by an English teacher to have us do poetry. And we really got nowhere until he gave us one of the most extreme poetic limits, to compose a sonnet.
Yes.
Which is an extremely difficult and definite limit.
That was my first poetic limit.
Within a sonnet, things came together.
Yes.
When you had any form you liked, including free verse to work with, it didn't come at all.
Yeah, that's right. Create 3-4-line sets and a couplet at the end.
And a definite rhyme scheme.
Yeah, that's right.
Iambic pentameter. Mm-hmm.
Yes. See, he still remembers it.
I don't forget that one.
Yeah. Okay. And then it's very important to have deferred judgment. You know, I used to just feel very unhappy for a child when the parents saw the child's creative product, the artwork, and said, "What is it?" You know, the child immediately then thinks he or she has to produce something to satisfy the parents' need for reality and for order, instead of just accepting the drawing as a product of the child's own creative imagination. Because think of all it took for that child to decide where to put that brush the first time and where to make it go. All of that effort and creative, you know, and then we want it to look like a house or a tree. And
would it be better then to ask the child to explain the picture to you?
You can do that, or you can just accept it. Sometimes they don't even have a story to it, and if you force them to have a story every time, then they become concerned with telling you the story than just, you know, producing. Sometimes they do make stories, especially 4-year-olds who are starting to make sense out of life. And so I've had children produce fantastic paintings after they'd had a freeway accident. They were involved in a freeway accident. Or when we had the big Bel Air fire where 400 homes were burned and we could see the burning hills from the Day Nursery in North Hollywood. And the way the children expressed their anxieties and their fears about that in paintings. Then they voluntarily told their own stories. And once they told it, they were through. You know, they didn't care to tell it over and over again, but it was there. So defer judgment. Don't ever let anybody critique your ideas. If you've got an idea for a book, don't ask somebody what they think of it. Because who cares? It's your idea. And ideas are so hard to come by. If later on you want some help when you get to the form and order stage, but when you have the passion and the vitality and you're gripped by your engagement with this idea, don't let anybody critique it for you. That is the worst thing you can do. I never tell anybody, you know, what I am in the process of writing until I'm through with it. And I guess like a lot of people, especially playwrights and all, they hate reviewers. Because reviewers impose their own notions of what is good and bad on the playwright. I know when we wrote our book, Bible Readings for Couples, that's a terribly dull name, but Augsburg Publishing House doesn't let us have the right to give them our own titles. They decide on them. Except, what do I have to do, break my neck? That was ours. But when somebody reviewed that, they talked about how exciting it was and how it gave a lot of food for thought to couples and a lot of possibilities for discussion. But they said the exegesis of the texts is not all that you would want. Well, we didn't start out by exegeting texts, you know. Mm-hmm. We were looking at something that would say something to human relationships. But the reviewer was a theologian, and he expected to have the texts perfectly exegeted. Well, that wasn't the purpose of the book.
In 15 sentences.
Yeah, in 15 sentences. Okay, so deferred judgment. Now, a big factor is motivation. And I listen to a lot of preachers. And the thing that I find lacking in so much preaching today is when you get through, you say, I enjoyed that. That was a nice sermon. But what are you motivated to do? Do you want to go out and win the world for Christ? Do you want to go out and live a more passionate life for justice? And I find that they are all very nice, but what are you motivated to do as a result of having heard the word? You know, are you motivated like Isaiah to say, here am I, Lord, send me? Or just go home and eat the roast? So I think motivation, when people ask me, how do you write a book? I say one word at a time. You know, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. You start, and you start doing it, and the shape starts taking form as you do it. But a lot of people have all these great plots in their mind, or all these great pictures, or all the songs they're going to write, and they never put a note down on paper. You've got to be motivated. Why did Carl Schalk and Herb Brokering, why were they able to produce 10 songs in 2 weeks? We were all waiting for them. And they had deadlines. They had to produce one a day as a result of Bowman's lectures. Deadlines, motivation, and sitting down together and doing it. And as a result, we had the product of these really fantastic songs. All right. There's another element in this whole business of the unconscious at work. And one of that is that there's a fear of the unconscious that inhibits people. All you have to do is look at Russia to realize that there's a fear of creativity in rationally ordered worlds. Why does Russia persecute poets and novelists? Yevtushenko, you know, Solzhenitsyn. Why? Because there's a fear in rational communities and countries of unconscious. There's a fear in individuals of the unconscious. What will I learn if I trust chaos? What will come up out of this unconscious part of me, which is the submerged part of an iceberg in me, and all my conscious mind is the tip of that iceberg? What will I discover about myself? Will it destroy my world? And you see, there's a fear because every creative act is, first of all, a destructive act. When Rollo May discovered that his hypothesis, and a hypothesis that all the other psychologists held, was not really a workable hypothesis with these unwed mothers, he knew what he feared was to go back and tell them that he had made this discovery, because he would destroy a lot of theses in process that were based upon a hypothesis that he had found erroneous. So there is some destruction involved in every new creative act. Okay, now what about love in this? I had chaos, creativity. Steve, did you want to say something?
I was going to respond to the comment you made about the problem of preaching. And being a preacher myself, you know, I'm somewhat defensive about that when I hear people say the problem. And so some of this comes from that. But I think part of the problem as well is the lack of motivation on persons' parts to want to be motivated to do anything. And I sense that, you know, I think this speaks somewhat to creativity in that I don't think it's only my responsibility to urge or coerce someone to be motivated if they indeed are not wanting or willing to be motivated themselves. And, you know, I sense in terms of that, what you're saying in terms of the fear of the unconscious, I think part of my own blockage in terms of creativity is the fear of wanting something to be perfect, that, you know, the fear of the unknown, of what is going to come out of this, and may not be judged very, may not be judged very well by others, for instance, and the fear of what is going to come from the chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't even enter into the creative process because you're fearful of what will then be come out of it. And so I don't know if that ties into the preaching.
Yeah, I think it does, because there's fear on both sides. Like if you pray, Holy Spirit, descend upon this congregation, you know, in the body. And then if it does happen, you know, what might happen? All kinds of things if the Spirit descends upon. Yeah, fear both ways.
That's it's personal responsibility of everyone. As a preacher, it's not only my responsibility to motivate.
But the receptivity.
Yeah, hopefully they'll be receptive to the Spirit or whatever would motivate them themselves, or maybe they even have to ask the question themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now what can I do? Or
yeah. As new forms of music emerge, for instance, the resistance to accepting new forms and new rhythms. As new forms of art emerge, the resistance to accepting Picasso, for instance, who in a sense was a prophet, because the dislocation and the alienation and the strangely dissected forms of human beings that Picasso envisioned were a foretaste of this robot technological age, which is in which we feel ourselves moving now. Yeah, so that's, thank you for clarifying that.
Could I add just a bit of dialectic?
Yes.
I think we're terrified of the chaos in society and our lives, so we wear nice clothing in church, and we sing a liturgy as best we can. I'm also a preacher, among other
Yeah.
people. And so I just like to suggest that part of the preaching problem is we're terrified of our own chaos, let alone to start looking underneath the smiles of 500 people in front of me on Sunday. And when we can preach with abandon, if we'll still be paid for another month. Exciting.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the freedom comes from not being paid and having to do other things.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I just like to suggest that I think preachers have indeed should assume 100% of the responsibility.
Yeah, it's always a tension between order and anarchy, mm-hmm. you know, too. So you have to keep those. But chaos trusted. Moving, pushing against limits becomes a dancing star. Now, where does love come in? Why did I attach that? I don't really know why I attached it, except it seems to me what love does for creativity is to not push too soon for order, to be able to help the person, support the person who is in the creative chaos during that time of chaos, to provide support but not push too quickly for a resolution of the chaos, and to give permission for all of the creative process, to say it's okay. Well, like I did for Louise Evenson, say trust, it'll come out. It's okay to feel this way, and to be honest in critiquing if someone asks you for that critique. But not too soon. Say, no, I won't speak. If somebody says, what do you think about this idea? Refuse to speak to the idea. Say, go with it. You know, go with it and see where it leads you. But when you're ready, when it's all in shape and you've given it form, I'll be glad to look at it at that point if you want me to. But go with it. Not want to enter into the process. And I know when I'm writing, I say to Erling and to the rest of the family, you know, don't expect to see me for 6 weeks. And don't expect me to be here. I probably won't hear you when you talk. You're going to have to feed yourselves. I may or may not eat. And I may not even talk to you because my mind is on my writing and it will absorb me. It'll obsess me day and night. And I don't want to be bothered with any extraneous material for 6 weeks. If I've got a deadline, see. But at the end of 6 weeks, I will emerge. And then please take me back. You know, don't reject me because I have been mean and rejecting of you for 6 weeks. Take me back because I've got to have this time. And people will do that when they're in the creative process. There is a withdrawal. Even in pregnancy, during the last months of pregnancy, there is usually a withdrawal. an inner withdrawal on the part of the mother that is not understood sometimes by people around. When as you come near the time of delivery, there's an innerness that develops, and then you emerge afterwards, you know, and you want to be received back, but during that time you may have alienated husband and children and because of your own inwardness. So part of the creative process is the need to be very inner-oriented and almost rejecting of the world outside. But if you're honest about this and you say, this is what has to happen now, forgive me and take me back. So love is very important, to know that people are out there. A whole dynamic that we can't deal with today, we don't have time to, is the relationship between sanity and insanity in the creative process. And I don't know, I had something here on that. I forget where it was. Oh, here it is. Frank Barron, a psychologist who was at Stanford, says, I would propose the following statements as descriptive of creative artists and perhaps also of creative scientists, you know, anybody who produces new ideas and a product of some kind that never really existed before. There's never been a book before this book, you know. This was a creative product. Nobody else had ever written a book called The Critical Moment or Conceptual Blockbusting. All right, he says, I would propose the following statement descriptive of creative artists and also of creative scientists. Creative people are especially observant. They value accurate observation, telling themselves the truth more than other people do. They often express part truths, but this they do vividly. The part they express is the generally unrecognized by displacement of accent and apparent disproportion in statement. They seek to point to the usually unobserved. They see things as others do, but also as others do not. They are thus independent in their cognition, and they also value clearer cognition. They will suffer great personal pain to testify correctly. They are born with greater brain capacity. They have more ability to hold many ideas at once and to compare more ideas with one another, hence to make a richer synthesis. In addition to unusual endowment in terms of cognitive ability, they are by constitution more vigorous and have available to them an exceptional fund of psychic and physical energy. Now, this can even be for somebody who has cerebral palsy, because the amount of physical energy it takes to move against the limits of your own body requires great physical energy. And so their universe is thus more complex. And in addition, they usually lead more complex lives, seeking tension in the interest of the pleasure they obtain upon its discharge. You'll seek tension. They have more contact than most people do with the life of the unconscious, with fantasy, reverie, the world of imagination, dreams, so on. They have exceptionally broad and flexible awareness of themselves. The self is strongest when it can regress, admits primitive fantasies, naive ideas, tabooed impulses into consciousness and behavior, and yet return to a high degree of rationality and self-criticism. The creative person is both more primitive and more cultured, more destructive and more constructive, crazier and saner than the average person. So, here's to all you crazy people. Go out and be creative. Thank you.